Penguin Random House Audio presents Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive, by Carl Zimmer. Read for you by Joe Ackman. To Grace, My Love and Life. Introduction. The Borderland. In the fall of 1904, the Cavendish Laboratory was full of curious experiments. Clouds of mercury shuddered with flashes of blue light. Lead cylinders pirouetted on copper disks. The ivy-covered building on Free School Lane, nestled in the heart of Cambridge, was the most exciting place for physicists to be, not just in England, but in the entire world, a place where they could toy with the fundamental pieces of the universe. Amidst this forest of magnets and vacuums and batteries, it would have been easy to overlook one small experiment sitting forlornly by itself. It consisted of little more than a glass tube capped with cotton, half filled with a few spoonfuls of brown broth. But something was coming into being in that tube. In a few months, the world would collectively gasp at it. Newspapers would celebrate the experiment as one of the most remarkable achievements in the history of science. One reporter would describe what lurked in the tube as the most primitive form of life, the missing link between the inorganic and organic worlds. This most primitive life was the creation of a 31-year-old physicist named John Butler Burke. In photographs from around the time of the experiment, Burke's boyish face has a melancholy cast. He was born in Manila to a Filipino mother and an Irish father. As a boy, he traveled to Dublin for schooling and ended up at Trinity College, where he studied X-rays, dynamos, and the mysterious sparks released by sugar. Trinity awarded Burke a gold medal in physics and chemistry. One professor described him as a man who is gifted with the power of exciting in others the enthusiasm which he brings to bear upon his own lines of investigation. After finishing his studies, Burke moved from Dublin to England to teach at a series of universities. His father soon died, and his mother, an old lady of very large means, as Burke later called her, supported him with a generous allowance. In 1898, Burke joined the Cavendish. Nowhere on earth had physicists learned so much in so little time about matter and energy. Their most recent triumph, courtesy of the lab's director, Joseph John Thomson, was the discovery of the electron. In his first few years at the Cavendish, Burke followed up on Thomson's work by running experiments of his own on the mysterious charged particles, investigating how electrons could light up clouds of gas. But then a new mystery lured him away. Like many other young physicists at the Cavendish, Burke started experimenting with a glowing new element called radium. A few years beforehand, in 1896, a French physicist named Henri Becquerel had discovered the first evidence that ordinary matter could cast off a strange form of energy. When he wrapped uranium salts in a black cloth, they created a ghostly image on a photographic plate nearby. It soon became clear that the uranium was steadily releasing some kind of potent particle. To follow up on Becquerel's work, Marie and Pierre Curie extracted uranium from an ore called pitchblende. In the process, they discovered that some of the energy was coming from a second element. They named it radium and christened its new form of energy radioactivity. Radium unleashed so much energy that it could keep itself warm. If scientists set a piece atop a block of ice, it could melt its own weight in water. When the Curies mixed radium with phosphorus, the particles unleashed by the radium made the phosphorus glow in the dark. As news of this rare exotic substance spread, it became a sensation. In New York, dancers put on radium-coated outfits to perform in darkened casinos. People wondered if radium would become a mainstay of civilization. Are we about to realize the chimerical dream of the alchemists? Lamps giving light perpetually without the consumption of oil? One chemist mused. Radium also seemed to have a vitalizing power. Gardeners sprinkled it on their flowers, convinced it could make them grow bigger. Some people drank liquid sunshine to cure all manner of ills, including even cancer. It was cancer that would eventually claim Marie Curie's life in 1934, probably because of the radium and other radioactive elements she worked with on a daily basis. Now that we understand the deadly risk posed by radioactivity, it's hard to imagine how anyone could think that radium could have vitalizing powers. But in the early 1900s, scientists knew surprisingly little about the nature of life. The best they could say was that its essence lurked in the jelly-like substance in cells, a material they called protoplasm. It somehow organized cells into living things and was passed down from one generation to the next. Beyond that, little was certain, and all manner of ideas were viable. To Burke, life and radioactivity displayed a profound similarity. Like a caterpillar becoming a moth, a radium atom could undergo a transformation that seemed to come from within. It changes its substance. In a limited sense, it lives, and yet it is ever the same, Burke declared in a 1903 magazine article. The distinction, apparently insuperable, that the biologist holds to exist between living and so-called dead matter should thus pass away as a false distinction. All matter is alive. That is my thesis. Burke said all this as a scientist, not a mystic. We must be careful lest our imagination should carry us away and lead us into regions of pure fancy, to a height beyond the support of experimental facts, he warned. To prove his thesis, Burke designed an experiment. He would use radium to create life from lifeless matter. To carry out this act of creation, Burke prepared some bouillon, cooking chunks of beef in water and sprinkling in salt and gelatin. Once the ingredients had turned to a broth, he poured some into a test tube and put it over a flame. The heat destroyed any cow cells or microbes that might be lurking in the liquid. All that was left was a sterile bouillon made up of loose, lifeless molecules. Burke put a pinch of radium salt in a tiny sealed vial, which was suspended over the broth. A platinum wire wrapped around the vial and snaked out a side port. To launch the experiment, Burke pulled the free end of the wire until the vial cracked. The radium tumbled into the broth below. After he let the radioactive broth stew overnight, Burke saw that it had changed. A cloudy layer had formed on its surface. Burke drew off a little to see if it was made of contaminating bacteria. He spread it over a petri dish loaded with food for microbes. If the cloudy layer had any bacteria in it, they would feast until they grew into visible colonies. But no colonies formed. Burke concluded the layer must have been formed by something else. Taking another sample of the cloudy layer, he spread it on a glass slide and put it under a microscope. Now he could see that it contained a scattering of specks far smaller than bacteria. A few hours later, when he checked again, the specks had vanished. But the next day they returned, and Burke began drawing them, documenting how they grew in size and changed in shape. Over the course of the next few days, they turned into spheres, with inner cores and outer rinds. They stretched into dumbbells. They bulged and pinched into miniature flowers. They divided. And then, after 2 weeks, they fell apart. Some might say they died. As Burke sketched these changing shapes, he could tell they were not bacteria. It wasn't just that they were too small. When Burke put some of them in water, they dissolved away, a fate that bacteria did not suffer. Yet Burke was convinced these radium-laced blobs were not crystals or any other familiar forms of lifeless matter. They are entitled to be classed among living things, Burke concluded. He had created artificial life, as he called it, creatures that existed at the far edges of life's territory. And to these things he gave a name that commemorated the element that gave birth to them, radiobes. Burke could only guess at how he had created his radiobes. When he dropped the radium into the broth, the element must have given the molecules the powers of growth, organization, and reproduction. The constituents of protoplasm are in the bouillon, he later wrote, but the vital flux is in the radium. That December, the scientists of the Cavendish Laboratory celebrated Burke's discovery at their annual dinner in a back room at a Cambridge restaurant. Dressed in black tie, they read lyrics written by a physicist named Frank Horton. They belted out "The Radium Atom" to the tune of an old music hall song. "Oh, I am a radium atom. In pitch blende I first saw the day. But soon I shall turn into helium. My energy's wasting away." The physicists sang about the gamma rays and beta rays that radium unleashed, and then they turned to Burke's experiment. Through me, they say, life was
sample complete. Ready to continue?